You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 100, Sound Meaning in Language with Dr. Ida Toivonen.
Hi, welcome to Minding the Brain. Today we are talking to Dr. Ida Toivonen, a linguist and cognitive scientist at Carleton University and a colleague of mine. And today we're going to talk about something that I find super interesting, and is how different languages distinguish different things right in their grammar and semantics. Welcome, Ida.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I'm a fan of your podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. So why don't you tell us about what we mean by languages having distinctions and stuff?
There are lots of different languages in the world. So people estimate maybe around 7,000 languages. And they make, of course, every language has their own vocabulary. So lots and lots of different words to describe things. But what I'm thinking about more is grammatical distinctions. So things that are part of the grammar of your language that you're not really at liberty to choose or to decide between. It's just, it's more automatic. You might, as a speaker, you might not have thought about the fact that you're using these distinctions. So when you choose words, you might have more, it might be more deliberate. It might be more, you know, what do you want to say? What words describe what I want to say? But how you say it, so the grammatical frame is more automatic and unconscious, I would say. So I'm thinking about those kinds of distinctions, like things like tense marking in English, for example. So if you utter a sentence, there's going to be tense there, present tense. So I am talking, or past tense, I talked.
Right. So, and then it's a mandatory.
It's mandatory. Right.
And I assume that sometimes languages can have non-mandatory distinctions too?
Yes. Yes, they can.
So, all right. So in English, we have, let's see, we've got tense is required, I guess, for verbs and for nouns, I guess, whether singular or plural is mandatory. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And for both of those things, there are languages that where that's not mandatory. So there are languages that don't mark tense. So I know you know Mandarin Chinese, right?
Yeah, yes.
And Mandarin Chinese doesn't have morphological tense the way English does. You can still talk about whether something will happen in the future or in the past. You can use aspect marking for that, which talks about event completion. Or you can use, of course, words like tomorrow or yesterday. But Chinese doesn't have tense. And there's other languages as well. I think Malay doesn't have tense.
Yeah, Chinese doesn't have mandatory plural singular distinctions either.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, well, let's talk about, I know that you've got some cool examples of things that maybe some of our listeners might never have even thought were possible. So you want to tell us about a couple of neat examples from different languages?
Well, so one example is, since we talked about numbers, singular, plural. So in English, when you, for all nouns, it's mandatory, whether, you know, it's singular or plural. So one book, many books. And a lot of languages make exactly that distinction. For on nouns, you have number marking. In a lot of languages also, that number marking on nouns has to be reinforced by other morphology. So for example, in English, you will say, you know, the book, but you'll also say the books, right? So the definite article, the, will look the same, whether it's singular or plural, but in some languages, it's going to differ depending on whether it's singular or plural. And then also you can have agreement marking of verbs. So what that is, in English, you just have a tiny, tiny bit of agreement marking. I walk compared to he walks. And he walks compared to they walk, I guess. So he walks and they walk. So there, if it's third person singular, you have a little S. Otherwise, if it's plural or first or second person, first person is the speaker, second person is the listener. You don't have that marker. But there are languages that also make other distinctions beyond singular and plural. So if you say have a noun, you can have book and you can have books, which is plural, but you might also have another form, a dual form, saying two books. So you could have something, I'm just making up a form, but let's say in English you said bouquet would be two books, book would be one book, bouquet would be two books, and books might be plural. There are also languages that have a trial, so one, two, and then a form for three. And there are languages that have a pakol, which is a few. So that's one distinction that's a quite common cross-linguistic. The trial and pakol are unusual, but dual is very common cross-linguistically, that you have a specific form for two. So when you utter a noun, it's going to be one, two, or many more than two. That's very common. Another thing that I know we've talked about, which also relates to your former research, I don't know if maybe you currently working on it too, and epistemology, is evidentiality. Mm. Evidentiality is you mark typically on the verb, you have to, in some languages, you have to mark the source of evidence. So if I say, for example, the cat chased the dog, maybe that's a bad example. Maybe dogs chase cats more often. What would you say, Jim?
I think I've seen both.
You've seen both. Okay, good.
And they're certainly both grammatically correct.
They're certainly both grammatical. But so let's say we say the cat chased the dog. In English, you have to have tense marking. The cat, a cat chases a dog, or a cat chased the dog. But in some languages, you have to mark, how do you know that? So there will be one marker. For example, in Tariana, which is a language spoken in Brazil, you mark it one way if you have seen it, if you have direct visual evidence, you saw the cat chasing the dog, then that would be one marker. Another marker would be, well, you have perceptual evidence, but it's not visual. So for example, you heard it. I don't know what that sounds like, but let's say you know, so you heard it. I guess it could be you felt it, although that would be unlikely in this particular example. And then they have visual, they have direct perceptual, which visual, direct perceptual, non-visual, and then they'll have reportative. The cat chased the dog, someone told me. And then they also have an inferential. I have some evidence, and based on that, I infer that the cat chased the dog. For maybe you have a cat and a dog, and some vases or something are toppled over, and based on that inferential evidence and things you know about the world and your cat and your dog, you can have the inferential marker there on the verb.
Wow.
So there are, yes, that's right.
So there's a couple of perceptual ones, a reported one, which I think we would call testimonial.
Mm-hmm.
And then an inferential one. Are there any more, or does that exhaust the?
Well, there's the perceptual. There's the two perceptual, visual and non-visual, perceptual, non-visual, and then there's reportative, and then there's inferential. There is a fifth one in Tariana that I know less about, and I forget what that is.
You forget that? Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I know in English, like if you wanted to say, if it was ambiguous whether something was plural or not, you would have to have a convoluted, like, when you bring over your book or books, you know, do you know if in these languages, if you're unsure, like you can't remember whether you heard it or saw it, you have a more convoluted way to describe it, you know?
That's a good question. I guess maybe you could, like you can do with present or past. If he walks or walked, you know, I guess you can. If he is walking or was walking, I guess you probably can. What I do know about these languages is that there are rules governing the choices. So if you've seen direct perceptual evidence, visual usually trumps everything else. So if you've seen something with your own eyes, then that's, and you also have inferential evidence and someone told you, then the visual will trump it. And languages differ on whether the inferential evidence trumps the reportative or if the reportative trumps the inferential. And sometimes it could be complicated things like reports by a reliable person, like the leader of the village or something will trump inferential, but the report of some, you know, drunk or someone that you don't trust would be under the inferential. So,
I guess there are, yeah, there are some facts about the world that could not be perceived. So,
yes,
like Australia is a country. Like you can't even go to Australia and see that it is a nation, right? You just see trees and people. So, like, I guess they would that just be like testimonial or inferential? I suppose you could never say that you saw that Australia is a country, probably.
Right. This is a good question. Now I'm thinking, because I know in a bunch of languages, so I myself actually don't study Tarayana. I've just read up on the evidentiality. So I don't know the language so specifically for Tarayana, but I know in a lot of languages when the evidential marking is obligatory, for a lot of languages it's only in the past tense. So you're saying something that happened. How do I know it happened? And in the present tense or the future, it's not obligatory.
Oh.
Which kind of makes sense.
So
right?
You want to say Australia is a nation, you don't need to have an evidentiality.
You might not need to have it, yeah.
Well, that's cool.
But still, it's an interesting question. There's this language called Yongning Na, which is spoken, I think, in Western China. So it's Tibet or Burman. And that has a very sophisticated evidentiality, system of evidentiality marking. And they have one marker means this is common knowledge.
Oh, so like, okay.
Yeah, so like the sun rises every morning, that would be marked common knowledge. And it can also be more particular common knowledge to the culture. Like this is where we burn the incense. Common knowledge. So you don't have to, yeah, or even if it's in past tense. So there's a common knowledge marker. And for that language too, they have common knowledge. Oh, they make a distinction between reportative and quotative, which is a little bit tricky. So the quotative would be used if it's a direct quote. Someone said, versus reportative is like, oh, it is said, or I hear that, you know, kind of reporting more hearsay. But they also have, yeah, so they have this common knowledge, they have a reportative, and they have a quotative, and they have an inferential, like we talked about before. But then there's also a possibility of not marking the past tense. And what that means then is you have direct evidence.
I see.
So if you don't mark how you know, then people just assume I know this because I have a direct experience.
Right.
Which kind of makes sense. I also feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm so much an academic, but I also feel like people have no business just making plain statements without hedging unless they have direct evidence.
Direct? What do you mean direct?
Well, so like if I say John is at home, unless like I know that, I know that for a fact, I should say he should be at home now, or I think he's at home, or he told me he's at home. I don't know. Maybe I'm like there.
I think it's a matter, I think that would be like you'd have to have judgment calls on it, because you could have three forms of evidence and it still be wrong. You could be like this, a victim of a big plot. So there's always some probability that you're wrong.
There's always some probability that you're wrong, I guess. But yeah. But I also think I'm of the opinion that people make plain statements too often without telling you why do you think, without hedging, saying, oh, I guess, or I suppose, and without saying, oh, someone told me, or I've heard that, or according to blah, blah, blah. But maybe that's like, maybe I'm so much an academic that you have to give your source.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for this conversation, for example, most of the things you're telling me about evidentiality, I would assume are testimonial.
Right.
Right. And so you don't need to mark it because...
All of them are, yeah.
I can figure it out.
And if this was a paper, we would, of course, be giving references, though, to specific sources. Yeah.
I just want the audience right now, I'm going to tell you that just to trust that Edith Hoivonen could provide you with references for all of these things, but it's a podcast, so we're not doing it.
That's right. But But you should also remind your audience that they should never believe anything, really. They should always go check stuff, right?
But yep. You especially if it matters, you should check it. Okay. Do you want to talk more about evidentiality or do you want to move on to another?
I can move on to another topic. Something that's very basic. I know we've been talking mostly about meaning and stuff, but I think I want to say something about at all levels of language or grammar, there will be big differences between languages, even sound inventories. So different languages have different sound inventories. So some languages have quite small sound inventories and some languages have big inventories. And English is somewhere in the middle. And I think that the smallest reported sound inventory would be, I think it's called Central Rotokas with 11 sounds.
So when you say sound, are you talking about like the basic units of?
Yes. Yes. And I know, so like pataka, a, u, u, the basic units.
Right. Okay. So just for the audience, the word bat has three, what linguists call phonemes, a b, a, and t. And English has, I think, 44 phonemes, and Japanese has fewer, and Hawaiian has fewer, and...
Yeah, and then, like, the language, which is a Khoisan language in Botswana, is reported to have the most, I think, like 110, 120 sounds or something.
No language has all of them, right?
No language is going to have all of them. And even in English, not all speakers have the same number of sounds. So, for example... some speakers will make a distinction between cotton caught, I guess, C-A-U-G-H-T. It's hard to spell like that. And C-O-T. So some speakers have two different vowels there that you can see in those words. And a lot of speakers have only one. Do you have two?
Oh, yeah. And I love it because in Ontario, so my accent is called Inland North. I'm from upstate New York, and I can distinguish marry, Mary, and Mary.
Right.
Like Mary is the thing you do with your spouse, and Mary is the name of Jesus's mom, and Mary is what you say before Christmas. But here in Ontario, they pronounce it all Mary.
That's right.
So locally, there's an ice cream shop called the Mary Dairy, but the rhyme doesn't work for me because I would say it's the Mary Dairy.
I see.
It doesn't quite rhyme.
But to Ontario speakers now, it might just sound like it rhymed perfectly well, even when you said it, right? Because...
Well, I don't know. They do make fun of me sometimes.
They do make fun of you. Yeah, like, right.
Especially my field, right? I'm in cognitive science, and I say cognitive, and around here they say cognitive.
Cognitive, yeah, yeah. So the Mary, 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 I said it all the same now. That distinction, some dialects will have two vowels there. You have three. A bunch of dialects have three. Yeah, some dialects of English will have two and split them up kind of differently. So that's, So even sound inventories, there are big differences. And also very high level differences between languages. So in English, we tend to mostly... There's pretty much, not exactly, but there's often a one-to-one mapping between like a concept and a word.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the black bag, those are three different words.
Right.
But we do have some, what we call morphology, some endings. So, you know, the black bags. So then... bags is one word, but it has, you know, the bag meaning and also the plural meaning. Some languages have basically no morphology like that. So walk, walked, clock, clocks. So some languages, in some Vietnamese and Chinese, it's quite, and I think Chinese for both Mandarin and Cantonese, it's quite one-to-one, the mapping, whereas some other languages just put a lot of meaning into single words. So one word could contain lots and lots of information, something that's kind of phonologically and morphologically one word. So as far as the structure goes, it's a single word, but it could carry the meaning of an entire sentence easily. So some examples of that would be Cayuga, for example, which I think is an Iroquoian language in spoken in Ontario by not very many people. Inuktitut is like that. So that's also a difference between languages. So all kinds of things. So at all levels of structure, basically, you get variation cross linguistically. Well, so another distinction that I'm interested in is animacy. So animacy in English, we talked a little bit about number distinctions, the singular plural, tense, which is present and past tense, is another distinction. And we talked about evidentiality, that that's quite common, but we don't really have grammatically in English. And then for a lot of languages, animacy is an important grammatical feature, like number and tense. So, one example is only nouns that refer to animates might be marked for singular plural, and there might be no plural forms for inanimate nouns.
So by animate, we're talking like living things and...
Yes, that's right. That's right. And we've talked about this before. The notion of animacy is actually kind of a complex... Thanks for saying that. Thanks for... is a complex notion, and that seems to involve, you know, agency, sentience, perception, and something that may be more relevant to kind of the mind and the brain that I've been thinking about is, well, so it's, you get animacy as a feature in grammars, and it relates to something, some kind of properties of entities, right? Do they have sentience? Do they have agency? Are they alive or dead? But all of those properties, it turns out, are actually very hard to determine. So even biologists, I'm not a biologist, so I don't know, but from what I've read, even biologists kind of debate exactly for certain things, are they alive or not? So viruses, for example.
Is locomotion one of these things? Like a plant is animate but very slow, but it can't locomote, like move around the earth. Is that?
That would count, yes. And then with movement, there's a difference between kind of agentive movement. Like, so if you're, are you moving on purpose? Do you choose to move? Compared to, are you just kind of moving? You know, if you're some kind of plant floating around in the water, you might be moving, but you might not be deciding to move. So then all kinds of plants, which are biologically, of course, alive, do cool things with movement, right? They move according to the sun. And then they can also kind of adapt to the environment.
Yeah, when you watch like vines in fast motion, it almost looks like an animal, but we're so, because of the rate at which we perceive things, it strikes us as not moving.
Right, exactly. So basically, but if you see a video like that, you might think, you might start talking about plants as if they're people because it looks like they're doing stuff. So my point is like, there's all kinds of these things. Another big area of research, I guess, which again, I'm not an expert in, is what kind of entities can feel pain? So can insects feel pain? Can plants feel pain? And that's like really not apparently clear. So basically, as a speaker of a language, if you mark animacy, some of these notions are going to be important, but we don't really know these things, right? So we only have access to the world through how we conceptualize it. So do we conceptualize these entities as agentive being, as sentient beings, right? So that's also why we can personify. So in English, animacy is a little bit reflected in he, she versus it.
Okay.
Right, he, she is typically used for humans and it for things. And then animals, well, it's unclear. Maybe we use it for animals if we know the gender, but also for close to them, right? And then also once we become close to our cars, for example, you might start calling it, give it a name and call it he or she. And right, so anyway, so that's, yeah, so animacy cross-linguistically, but animacy also often, so in English, there's the he, she versus it. So there's a little bit of a thing where you have to make a choice there, which pronoun do you use? But otherwise, animacy doesn't play a huge role in grammars. But in a lot of languages, it does play a big role. So for example, you only have plural forms for animates. And then in other languages, we talked a little bit about agreement marking. So the way you say she walks, but I walk. So the marker on the verb, and anyone who's studied a language like French or German or you know, Spanish, a lot of languages have these verbal paradigms, right, where the verb changes according to the subject. And animacy is often relevant for that. So, for example, one thing that's very, very common is if you have a different verb form for singular and plural, you'll use that for animates and not inanimates.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So that's very common. That happens in, for example, actually Turkish and Farsi. So it's that's very common. So you kind of have to, in your normal daily speech, you kind of have to pay attention to this animacy distinction. And languages differ, though. So I'm saying animacy, and you pointed out, well, you know, what does it mean? So it's connected to all these different things like agency and sentience, I guess, and being alive and not alive. But it turns out also different languages make the distinction at different make this distinction in different ways. So in some languages, the distinction between humans and other is important. And in other languages, it's actually human and animals are grouped together and then other. For some reason, plants typically go with things.
Yeah.
Grammatically.
This reminds me of, like, how translation can really lose information, right? Because if you've got a animacy marking
language and you've got somebody says something like Denver is hot, and Denver could be the name of a pet or the city. That might be clear in the original language because they have animacy marking.
That's right.
Then you try to translate it into English, and that's lost. And if you were to try to put it back in the original language, there'd be information lost there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's one reason why translation is very tricky. And that's been also traditionally. So now we have very good translation engines, but certain things, if you just translate a text and you don't have the context, it's not like, if you don't have the information, you don't have it, right? So
yeah.
I guess the machines probably make decisions based on what would be more common, maybe?
Yeah. If you're talking about the modern deep learning translators, yeah.
The modern ones, which are very good.
Yeah, for translation, they're quite impressive, yeah.
Cross-linguistically, though, we've been talking about, well, I've been talking about some, like, languages make different kinds of distinctions. And I've been particularly interested in things which are just part of, like, when you make a sentence in past tense, you have to decide, is the subject animate or inanimate? What source of evidence do I have? Things like that. So with animacy, there are interesting things that are tendencies cross-linguistically that have been grammaticalized in some languages. So for example, cross-linguistically, well, certainly, yeah, cross-linguistically, I can say this, I've thought about this. In a lot of languages, maybe all languages, it's common to put entities with high animacy are often subjects, and they're often pronounced first in the sentence. So humans over animals and inanimates, and animates over inanimates. So that's common cross-linguistically, but it's not. So in English, for example, in most languages, it's not a rule of grammar. So a sentence like, you know, the man broke the door would be more common than the door broke the cup, or the door broke the man. But one could imagine, it's not ungrammatical, and one could imagine, oh, the door falls over and it breaks the man's head or something. Like, it's a bit of an odd sentence, but certainly the wind killed the child. That's mm-hmm. a horrible thing to say, but that's is for sure possible to have inanimate subjects acting on animate objects. Mm-hmm. But in some languages, but there's a tendency for subjects to be animates and right. objects to be inanimate. And in some languages like Jakaltek, which is a Mayan language, Mem, which is a Mayan language, it also happens in Salish and languages. In some languages, this has been grammaticalized. So you're not allowed to say a sentence where the subject is higher in, no, the subject is lower in animacy than the object. So you couldn't say the door killed the man. It would be ungrammatical. So if that event happens in the world and you want to say it, there would be, you would have to do something. You would have to, you know, use a passive or a different construction. But with a plain, regular sentence.
So you could, okay. So you might say like...
You can. It's not like you can't express it. Like
right.
You can express it, but you can't just say it in a regular...
Okay. So if we assume that like a disease is inanimate, right? We might mm-hmm. say that like the Andrew was killed by cancer. Because,
right, exactly.
But just maybe this is getting a little technical. But if I say Andrew was killed by cancer, isn't cancer still the subject of the sentence?
Well, no, it's still the agent, but it's not the subject. Andrew is the subject, which we know because we would it agree. Well, cancer is also singular, but it agrees with the verb. If you pronominalize, it would be he, not him. So yeah,
okay.
So Andrew is then grammatically the subject, but semantically it's kind of still the patient.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, so cross-linguistically. And can I say one more thing about animacy? Just because
please.
I thought, oh my God, poor you.
We have
you.
All the time in the world to talk about animacy.
Do we? Well, there's an example where I think, I'm assuming a lot of your listeners will have studied Spanish, for example, and
okay.
in Spanish and a lot of other languages, you have something called, well, it's called differential object marking, but basically different kinds of objects will be marked in different ways. And what an object is the thing being done to. So in a sentence like John saw the car, John would be the subject and the car would be the object, right? So in Spanish, for example, and in a lot of other languages, but in Spanish, if you say John saw the car, you would just say John saw the car. If you say John saw the girl, you would have an a preposition there. You would have a marker for the object. So animates get marked with a, and animate objects get marked with an a, and inanimate objects don't.
Oh,
and
neat.
That's common cross-linguistically, like in Romanian, for example. So, yeah. So I'm just saying that as an example of a grammatical reflex of animacy that I'm imagining at least some of your listeners might have learned.
Yeah, already. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Are there any more, so these things like animacy and I was going to ask if there are markers, like we all sort of understand, we all have some understanding of animate and inanimate.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to think of like a marker that maybe not everyone would already have the concept of. And I guess certain gender markings would be very unusual and hard to pick up.
Well, there are things like, so now I forget what language, but like there are languages where you have kind of markers people have argued they're a different kind of word class, so not really prepositions, not really nouns, and they have to say something about, I guess, the main actor or the main noun in the sentence. They say something about the position, so standing upright or is enclosed in a container. I mean, I guess that's something we can imagine, but it would be like, so that's part, and I don't know, so I don't know very much about this phenomenon, but that's one thing that's kind of unusual. So you have like these things like particles similar to up and down or whatever, but they go in sentences, and I think they're very, very common. Maybe they're obligatory in certain kinds of sentences, not others. I actually don't know, but where they say something about the position of the object. There's also these, so there's gender systems, right? So masculine and feminine and in Spanish and Italian. And of course, they're only very loosely related to any kind of... So it's multiply complicated because there's grammatical gender And there is like the construct gender.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's biological sex. And the matching between all three of them is very kind of loosey-goosey, especially since, you know, you have every noun will have a gender. A lot of languages like German, for example, would have three genders. So masculine, feminine, and neuter. But then there's also these, a lot of African languages have different noun classes. So they have a large number of noun classes. So they could be like maybe masculine or human. And then they could be like, and then the noun classes are loosely defined. And often there are certain words you just have to memorize what class it goes to. But it could be elongated objects or, you know, foods or something like that. And that's part of the grammar. So they'll have different, so it's as if you would have different, so the definite article, the. So let's say you have 14 noun classes. You might have 14 the.
Oh, wow.
Thus. And also the agreement marking on verb would be different from all the noun classes. Yeah, I get so happy when I think about this. So I start giggling.
Yeah, it's so cool and it's neat. You know, you study a foreign language, you might have to learn whole new categorizations that never dawned on you before.
That's right. That's right. You do. There will be at least some things that will be new and hard, right? When you study a foreign language, even if you study a language like French, that's pretty close to English, really, there is going to be stuff. So people who've studied French will have struggled with passé composé and imparfait, right? The two different past tenses.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ida, thank you so much for this little exploration of different categories in language. And it was great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Jim. And we'll chat. I'll see you soon and we'll chat again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and Language, without which this podcast would be a half hour of laughing and snorting. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.